Might turn tonight to Matthew chapter 24. I'd like to talk about the sign of the fig tree. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 32. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When its branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Way back in 1988, I was scheduled to be speaking at a church in Florida towards the end of the year. Around about March or April of that year, I received a phone call from the lady that organized and did the inviting of the speakers. And she said to me, "We would like you to come before September." I said, "Why do you want me to come before September? I can't come anyway. I'm coming in November, and I booked up solid for the rest of the year, but why do you want me to come before September?" Well, she said, "The Lord is coming." Well, I said, "I believe that. What's that got to do with it?" Well, she said, "It's the Feast of Trumpets." I said, "I'm sorry, but I don't get the connection. Why do you want me to come before September?" She said, "It's the year of Jubilee." I said, "So what?" Well, she said, "This is the first Jubilee that the Jews have spent in the land, and it's the Feast of Trumpets. And the Lord's coming. We want you to come before September." I finally figured out she had been reading a book. 88 Reasons Why the Lord Will Come in 88. The book was quite obviously well financed. It was sent to hundreds upon hundreds of Christian leaders all across the country, free. I had phone calls from as far away as northern British Columbia. People were wondering if there was something to this. The book was a very interesting book. It was written by a retired NASA space engineer. It contained an extraordinary amount of very interesting information and a great deal of misinformation based on three false premises. But it convinced a lot of people. A lot of people thought this was for sure. The Lord was coming in September, Sunday, September the 11th, Monday, September the 12th, or Tuesday, September the 13th. Absolutely convinced that the Lord was coming on one of those 3 days. I remember I was out in Oklahoma about that time in 1988 in September. And we were driving across the state. We had the car radio on, and these people were on the radio telling people, "Get ready, Lord's coming Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday." A lot of people believed it. They got rapture parties going. Media got a hold of it, made the front page in some newspapers. And of course, the Lord didn't come. I called up my friend on September 14th or thereabouts, and I said, "Oh, hello, Margaret, how come you missed the rapture?" A preacher friend of mine, J. Harold Smith, one of the big evangelists with the Southern Baptists, good man. He and I were preaching in the Bahamas several years ago, just shortly after this, and we got talking about this thing and this fella. He said to me, he said, I called him up on the telephone. I said, "Is that right, Harold? What do you say to him?" Well, he said, when he answered the phone, I said to him, "Are you Mr. Wisenant?" He said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Are you the Edgar C. Wisenant that wrote that book, 88 Reasons Why the Lord Will Come in 88? He said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Do you really believe that? Do you believe the Lord's coming this year? Later on this year, September? 11, 12, or 13? He said, "Of course I believe that. I wrote that in my book." Well, he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He said, "I'll buy your house. I'll buy your car." He said, "I'll give you $5,000 for your house. I'll give you $500 for your car." And he said, "We can get the deeds made up right away. You can have the money right now. I'll send you the check. And I'll take possession on September the 14th. The guy wouldn't sell. Well, that's the way it goes, you know. The media got a hold of it and made fun of us. It's been happening. Peter said, ever since the father fell asleep, they've been talking about the Lord coming. Where is the promise of his coming? Where is? Well, why doesn't he show up? And the agnostic press and the humanist press got busy and had a heyday. But the Lord is coming. We don't know when. But we can know he's coming because he said, "When you see the fig tree putting forth its leaves, you know that summer's nigh. When you see these things, know that it's near, even at the doors." And we've seen the budding of the fig tree. Fig tree in the Bible represents the nation of Israel between the nation's rejection of Christ. And the coming again of the Lord Jesus Christ is portrayed as a fig tree. When I was 18 years of age, I received a letter in the mail one day from the king, King George VI. He was king of England that time. And I received a letter in the mail from the king. I knew it was from the king because on the front of the envelope it said in big letters right across the top, "On His Majesty's Service." And there was no stamp on the letter. The king doesn't pay postage. He can't afford it. Well, you know, I was very anxious to see what the king had to say to me, so I tore the letter open, and I was very disappointed. It was a form letter. It said, "Dear John, join the army or else." "Your else" wasn't very attractive. In those days, they sent you down in the coal mines to dig coal if you wouldn't go in the army. Either that or they put you in prison. However, I was always thankful that I was drafted into the British Army, because in the sovereign overruling providence of God, of all places in this world where I could have been sent, I was sent to Palestine. In those days, it was still a mandated territory of the British Empire. And I was there for 2 years, stationed on Haifa Docks, and developed over that period of time a very keen interest in the Jewish people, in the Jewish state, and in the signs of the times and prophecy in general. The rebirth of the state of Israel in our generation is a miracle of history. Absolute miracle. In many ways. That a nation that had been uprooted and scattered and buried amongst the nations for 2,000 years should suddenly come back to life again is without precedent in history. It's only happened to the Jew. It doesn't happen to anybody else. It's happened to the Jew 3 times. It all began with a man by the name of Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl was a journalist, a Jew, in France, about the time of the Dreyfus trial. Dreyfus was a Jewish officer in the French army. The French high command was anti-Semitic. They didn't like Jews. They decided to get rid of this fellow. So they trumped up charges against him, accused him of high treason, gave him a mock trial, and discharged him dishonorably from the army and put him in prison. Not a word of it was true. And then there were outbursts of anti-Semitism across Paris and the country. Synagogues were burned. And Theodor Herzl, an Austrian Jew, observed all this, and he decided that there was no future for the Jew in Europe. He didn't know where the trouble was coming from. He thought it would be France. Of course, he was wrong. It was Germany. But he knew that the Jew was unwanted in Europe. He was far-sighted enough to see that. His first reaction to the Dreyfus trial and to the surge of anti-Semitism was to suggest that all Jews should convert to Christianity. That would remove the problem. Now, his idea of Christianity was a bit haywire. He thought all Jews ought to become Roman Catholics. And if all Jews became Roman Catholics, then they would be accepted. It was a silly idea. For one thing, most Jews had no intention of becoming Roman Catholics. And then he had another idea. He said, well, if you can't convert them to Catholicism, the next best thing to do is to have your own state. They're not wanted in Europe. Let's have our own state. And he convened a convention in Geneva, Switzerland, in the closing years of the 1800s. And he gave birth to what was called the Zionist movement. He decided that the thing for the Jews of the world to do was to go back to Palestine. The rallying call of the Zionists was, there is a land without a people, there is a people without a land, give the land without a people to the people without a land. That was very largely true at that time. Palestine was part of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was in the last stages of decay and rot. They had no use for Palestine at all. It was just a little tiny country, mostly barren. They'd cut down all the trees and turned the country into wilderness. One or two small little enclaves of Arabs here and there. A few nomadic Arabs wandering around, but very largely the country was depopulated. Nobody wanted it. It wasn't worth anything. Nothing would grow there. Had no resources. It was a land without a people. And there was a people without a land. Theodor Herzl said, why not put two and two together, put the land without a people, give it to the people without a land. Most Jews thought he was nuts. However, a wave of persecution, anti-Semitic persecution in Eastern Europe about that time, gave impetus to the Zionist movement, and Jews began to trek back to that country from various Eastern European countries. They were pioneers. They decided to reclaim the land. They broke their backs and their health, clearing malarial areas, swamps, removing stones, planting trees, trying to get some kind of agriculture going in a land that had been totally neglected for hundreds of years. Not very much happened until the First World War. During the First World War, Britain suddenly discovered that she'd run out of cordite for the manufacture of gunpowder. That meant, in practical terms, that she'd lost the war. The situation was absolutely desperate. The British government appealed to a Jewish chemist, a brilliant man by the name of Chaim Weizmann. They asked Mr. Weizmann if he could find a way to manufacture synthetic substance that would be used for high explosives. And he found a way of utilizing horse chestnuts that grow profusely and wild everywhere in Britain, and practically saved the British Empire. A grateful British government asked Chaim Weizmann what he would like by way of recognition. He said, "Nothing for me but recognition for my people." And he asked the British government to consider establishing a national home for the Jew in Palestine when the war was over. In response, the British government issued a very famous document known as the Balfour Declaration. In the Balfour Declaration, His Majesty's government pledged itself to help establish a national home for the Jew in Palestine when the war was over. During the course of the First World War, Britain sent an expeditionary force into the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire, the Turks, had sided with Germany. And, of course, they were fair game. They were the enemy. Britain sent General Lord Allenby with an expeditionary force into the Middle East, rolled up Turkish power in the area like a worn-out Turkish carpet. All those countries fell one after the other to successful British arms, including Palestine. Palestine now belonged to Britain by right of conquest. After the war, the British government remembered the Balfour Declaration, and they appealed to the League of Nations for a mandate from that world body to establish a national home for the Jew in Palestine, a country very largely depopulated. They received a mandate to accomplish that purpose. First thing Britain did when she received the mandate over Palestine was to take a pragmatic view of the situation. Palestine, the Palestine that was given to Britain, was both sides of the Jordan. The old Bible Palestine. The British decided that the thing to do was to partition the country. And so they divided the country into two along the line of the Jordan River. The east side of the Jordan River would be a national home for the Arabs. The west side of the Jordan River would be a national home for the Jews. In the pursuit of this policy, they created a country that had never existed before. The country of Jordan. There never ever was such a country up until after the First World War, when the British Foreign Office created the country and gave it a government, gave it a king, King Abdullah, and created that country to be a place where Arabs could go who did not like living in a Jewish state. And they then began to develop a Jewish state on the west side of the Jordan River. It wasn't long before the Arabs began to realize that the Jews were coming back in increasing numbers. They were building a very viable state under British tutelage. The British had done for Israel what they had done for Jordan. They created the infrastructure of government, built roads and railways, postal service, all those kind of things. But the Arabs looked with envy because the Jewish side of the country was prospering. The Jews had a middle class, no middle class amongst the Arabs in those days. When I was in the British Army in Palestine, I never saw a middle class Arab, hardly ever. They're either very, very wealthy or else desperately poor. So the Arabs began to revolt. And in the 1930s, there was a series of atrocities committed, terrorist attacks against British installations in the Jewish side of Palestine. And those atrocities continued right up until the outbreak of the Second World War. About this time, a new voice began to be heard in the councils of Europe, the voice of a man called Adolf Schicklgruber, Adolf Hitler. His strident voice was heard denouncing the Jews and promising that when he came to power, he'd eradicate all Jews from Germany, and had already written into Mein Kampf that he intended to eradicate all European Jewry, given the opportunity. With a new war beginning to loom on the horizon, Britain realized that she had vast oil interests in the Middle East. At that time, the British Empire was still intact. Nearly all that part of the world was painted red. That was part of the British Empire. British Empire started with Egypt, the Sudan, Palestine, Jordan, Arabia, the Emirates, most of them, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, India, right on through to Singapore, all part of the British Empire. Nearly all those oil-producing Arab countries were controlled from London. But Hitler was making great strides and inroads into the Arab world by his anti-Semitic propaganda, his Jew hate. That just appealed the Arabs no end. And Britain faced the spectacle of the Arab states siding with Germany over Jewish immigration into Palestine. So she did a very foolish thing. She strong-armed the Jews. What most people don't realize is that God signed a treaty with the nation of Israel, with the Jewish people. That's the only people on this planet with whom God ever signed a treaty. He signed it first of all with Abraham, then with Isaac, then with Jacob. And through Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel. God has a treaty with that nation. He doesn't have a treaty with the United States. He never signed a treaty with the British Empire. He did sign a treaty with the Jew. And on the terms of those treaties, God said, if anyone blesses you, I'll bless them. And if they curse you, I'll curse them. In foreign policy, a country that wants to survive should keep its hands off the Jew. If you can't bless them, if you can't help them, then leave them alone. Because if you don't, God will deal with you. Well, Britain, seeing her oil interest imperiled in the Middle East by the rising surge of Nazism and anti-Semitism in Germany, siding with the anti-Semitism of the Arabs, she issued what they called a white paper, which effectively cancelled any further Jewish immigration into the country. At the time in history when the Jews, more than any other time in all their history, needed a place to go, Britain slammed the door to further Jewish immigration into Palestine and said, you're not coming back here. We're not going to have any more trouble with the Arabs over oil. God said, I won't forget that. When the war was over, Hitler was defeated. The surviving remnants of the Jewish European population, the survivors of the Holocaust, those who went through those horror camps and somehow stayed alive, they wanted to get out of Europe. Herzl had been right all the time. Europe was no place for Jews. Zionists began to round them up by the hundreds of thousands, and they had an escape route. They brought them down to the coastline of the Mediterranean. And then they would buy any old crate that would make one trip down the Mediterranean, load that ship with Jews till they couldn't get another one on, till the boat was almost level with the water. Then head it down the Mediterranean towards the coastland of Palestine. All they needed to do was ditch that ship somewhere on the coast. The Haganah, the Jewish underground army, and the Zionist organization would do the rest. They smuggled 600,000 Jews into the country that way. Britain eventually caught on to what was happening and decided to put a stop to it. By now, they had a leftist Labour government in Britain. Very pro-communist. Very anti-Semitic. And they decided they're going to put a stop to this. Yeah, there's uprisings every day in Palestine. I was drafted there about this time. If it wasn't the Jews blowing stuff up, it was the Arabs. It wasn't the Arabs shooting British soldiers, it was the Jews. Britain decided they were going to put a stop to this infiltrating Jews into the country. They used to send their battleships out into the Mediterranean, and they'd trail these immigrant ships down the Mediterranean until they crossed territorial waters, and then they would seize the ship, bring it into Haifa docks, put martial law on the city. Saw it happen many times. Take the Jews off those vessels, spray them with DDT. I saw the Jews time and time again walking skeletons, men, women, children, with horror written all over their faces. They'd get off those ships. They'd come home, they thought. They'd come home, they'd fall down, kiss the soil, look at Mount Carmel, tears running down their cheeks, only to find that the British were no friends. British sprayed them with DDT to kill the lice, then put them down the hold in a British cargo vessel, now under the British flag, battened them down like so much cattle, took them back out to sea, put them back behind barbed wire on the island of Cyprus. God said, I won't forget that. I won't forget that. Mind you, the British had a great deal of provocation. The Jewish terrorist organizations were just as bad as any terrorist organization today. I remember one occasion they caught three young British officers. The British had caught a couple of Jewish terrorists and had sentenced them to death and proposed to hang them. And the Irgun, that was one of the terrorist organizations headed by Menachem Begin, who later became Prime Minister of Israel, was a terrorist in those days. And Begin said, if you hang those terrorists, we'll hang the same number of British officers. Well, Britain went ahead, hanged those terrorists, and the Irgun hanged the same number of British officers, and then booby-trapped their bodies. There was a nasty, nasty war, and there was provocation on both sides. Finally, Britain decided she'd had enough. I don't know what time this thing ends. What time I got to quit talking? Want me to stop right now? I want to go home? Hands up, all those who want to go home. About 5 more minutes. My wife always reminds me, you know, that meeting something. I never pay any attention. Britain decided she had enough, turned what they called the Palestine problem over to the United Nations. The United Nations, their solution, although Britain had partitioned Palestine once and created the state of Jordan, the glorious decision of the United Nations was to partition it again, and they gave all the best land to the Arabs and a patchwork quilt of indefensible territory to the Jews. Britain pulled out. When Britain pulled out of Palestine, I was in one of the first batches of soldiers that were withdrawn from the country. I'd been stationed on Haifa docks for 2 years in charge of bringing in military supplies into the country. involved in that anyway. They've been bringing military supplies into the country as fast as they could ship it in there for years. Then they decided to get out. They had to get out in days. They couldn't take it all with them, obviously. The stuff that had taken years to bring in, they had to leave it behind. And as a final act of betrayal, Britain left all her military installations and equipment in the hands of the Arabs. God said, I'm through. That's it. What use do I have for this British Empire? Within 10 years, Britain was a bankrupt island off the coast of Europe, and her empire was gone. Should be a warning for Americans. Don't shove Israel around if you want to survive as a great power. God can get along quite well without you. So they've gone back. And they've survived a number of hostile, very, very costly wars. They're a force to be reckoned with in the world. They're there to stay, and the fact they've gone back. Jesus said, you watch the fig tree. When you see the fig tree come back to life, when you see the Jewish nation reborn, that's the sign. When the Jews go back, I'm coming back. Well, they've gone back. And now he's coming back. They've gone back 3 times. They went back, first of all, from Egypt in the days of the Exodus, and they gave the world the Bible. He went back a second time from Babylon after the Babylonian exile, and they gave the world Jesus. And now they've gone back again. They don't know this, but they're about to give the world the second coming of Christ. Be ye therefore ready. Father, we thank you that Jesus is coming again, and that his coming draweth nigh. We have every indication upon the world stage that all these things referred to in that chapter are now beginning to be, that there is activity in every single area described and discussed by the Lord Jesus Christ in that great prophetic discourse. Everywhere we look, we see the same picture. And the Jews have come back, and you're coming back. And you say again and again in that chapter that we are to be ready. Ready. May we be ready, for we ask it in his name. Amen.